This episode is brought to you by videoblocks.com. Go to videoblocks.com/notalone to learn how to claim your exclusive offer for being a listener of the Not Alone podcast. We are also brought to you by the amazing support of our patrons over at patreon.com/notalonepodcast. Head over there to find out how you can get access to the show a few days early. You can get access to bonus episodes, all sorts of great rewards for supporting your favorite show. Again, that's patreon.com/notalonepodcast. Thank you so much to everyone who pledges to us each month and really helps us keep the lights on.
Ace Podcast.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And this week we are concluding our series on the murder of Charles Walton.
Oh yeah, the wrap-up.
The fond farewell.
There we go.
Of Charles Walton. But before we get started on that, I have a few things I'd like to address. The first one is some great listener feedback that we got from my buddy Dom. Hi, Dom.
What's up, man?
He wanted... I know this person. We played Magic together.
Yeah.
He wanted me to say,
oh,
and rightfully so,
fun days.
Back when we had time for magic, he wanted me to point out, or he mentioned to me, and I think it's right to point out, we talked a lot about paganism and witchcraft and them being intertwined, which they totally are, right? But the important thing that we failed to really mention is that while paganism and witchcraft are, of course, related...
They're not one in the same.
Yeah, they're not one in the same.
No, that's fair.
Not all pagans. Not to mention, paganism is just such a broad
term. Oh, yeah. It's literally the term to describe any polytheistic religion.
Yeah, the Hellenistic traditions, Celtic traditions.
Again, poly, yeah.
Eastern, Western, everything poly, yeah. So while all witches most likely have a paganistic aspect to them, not all pagans are witches, practitioners of witchcraft, or anything like that. So that's important. I wanted to bring that up. Thank you, Dom. I still haven't texted you back thanking you for that because I've been so busy. So thank you, Dom.
So in case he doesn't text you back, well, yeah,
there we go.
Heard it here.
And in addition to that, I just want to say, Jason.
What's up, Sam?
There's something different about you.
Yeah? Is there something missing?
I feel like you're less of an individual.
I don't know, man. It's on the tip of my tongue. But it's not on the tip of my thumb.
Yeah. Jason cut his thumb off.
Yeah, I cut the very tip of my thumb off when I was chopping an onion. So,
dang.
I just needed to cut my thumbnail at the same time.
Yeah.
So I just, hey, two birds, one stone.
There you go.
That stone was a very sharp knife.
How is your thumb doing,
dude?
Jason?
It's great, man.
Okay.
Unless I try to use it. And
oh,
it becomes a problem.
No.
Without your thumb, your hand is pointless.
Oh, yeah.
Really,
oh, yeah. There's a reason we have mastery over the beasts.
I was just like...
It's that thumb.
I was thinking about it. I'm like, no wonder our dogs get so upset because they just don't have thumbs.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm sorry, little dude, but...
It's true.
I'm sorry, Baron.
It's true.
I now understand your struggle. But yeah, I'm a little bit less of a person right now.
Just a tiny bit. So,
yep.
Just to be straight here, you didn't go to the doctor.
No. I FaceTime my brother, and he's an EMT, so I mean, like, it's the same thing. There's, like, nothing to sew back on. There's nothing to do.
Okay. All right. Well, that's Jason. I don't
making
know.
Making mistakes.
Yeah.
Living and learning.
I'm keeping all that in.
Oh, great.
So, just so everybody knows. Cool. So, we've got those two important announcements out of the way.
Compression and Neosporin.
All right.
It's okay. I get it from my father. Like, literally, any knife that he buys, he has to cut himself some way with it.
Well, that's just a part of blood sacrifice, isn't it?
Maybe. Take my thumbs.
And with that, we are segueing away from this subject that I am sorry that
idea.
I broached.
Yeah,
and
this is what happens when you get me talking about my physical injuries.
We are getting back to the murder of Charles Walton. No, I already saw a picture of it.
You haven't seen it kind of healing. It's weird, dude. It's weird.
You haven't seen it in all its different stages and its splendorous glory.
Yeah, buddy.
Okay, we're gonna move away from the thumb.
Okay.
As you should have done with that knife. And we're going to move towards the dead man laying in Warwickshire. That's the other correction. It's Warwickshire, apparently.
Not Warwickshire.
Not Warwickshire.
Right.
Warwickshire. So thank you for that as well, dear listeners. Now, we mentioned at the start of the last episode that there is one suspect. By the way, if you haven't gotten this yet, it's a two-parter. Go back. Listen to part one. Okay? It's pretty important.
It really set the stage.
Scene. Yes. Yeah. So, as we mentioned at the start of the last episode, there was one subject who pulled out near the start of Fabian's investigation as the most likely candidate to have murdered Charles Walton. Now, that man was Charles Walton's employer, a man who goes by the name of Alfred, sometimes referred to as Albert, sometimes referred to as John Albert, sometimes referred to as John Alfred.
He's got a lot of aliases.
Potter. It's actually not aliases as much as I think it is. He just goes by different things. Now, we need to back up to the day of the murder in order to better understand the case against Potter. Now, the first piece of evidence, or first conjecture of evidence, is Potter's account of seeing Walton working in the fields, around noon after enjoying some time at the local pub. Now, when questioned by Fabian, Potter revealed that the individual he had seen was wearing his shirt sleeves. He wasn't wearing anything over them. Charles Walton, like we mentioned, was an older gentleman, and he suffered from rheumatism. And according to his wife and the people who had seen him walking through the village that day...
Which rheumatism is like arthritis?
Arthritis, okay. Yes. According to those people who had seen him earlier in the day and his body when it was found, he was pretty well bundled up. It was February. He was cold. He was an older gentleman. This seems like a strange detail to really stick on, but Potter refused to recant it. Even to the point of Potter saying, I agree with you that it couldn't have been Charles Walton wearing nothing but his shirt sleeves, but I did see someone wearing nothing but their shirt sleeves in that area. So from the start, you either have, okay, Potter's being completely honest, or he's attempting to deflect attention to some unknown shadowy figure in
with
the field.
With shirt sleeves.
Now, from the moment that the body was discovered, Potter was acting strangely, to say the least.
Would you say peculiar?
Peculiar. Now, the first officer on the scene was a Mr. Michael Lomasney. Now, the Firs, which was, of course, Potter's farm, was on Lomasney's beat, and so he felt like he knew them pretty well. And according to Lomasney, Potter made a few strange statements, and his demeanor just kind of seemed off. Now, Lomasney stated that one of the first things he heard Potter say was, it's a devil, this happening on my land. What will the public say? You know what they are around Quentin. And no one really asked him to further elaborate on that statement because there was a dead man.
What do you mean?
And maybe that is what he should have been focused on, is the dead man, and not what people were going to say. I mean, I guess. Now, when Potter was shown Walton's walking stick, which had his hair and his blood on it, Potter freaked out. He said, I absolutely hate the sight of blood, which is very strange.
That's a very strange British accent.
Right. It's also very strange because Potter slaughters animals for a living.
I mean, I think there's a difference between like human blood and animal blood.
I guess so. You know, and that is...
And like, you just saw the blood. It's like, whatever. But if you're like, oh man, that's human blood. Like, I think that's a different impact.
I guess, but I think... And that's totally something that people bring up to as a counterpoint, which is totally fair. But I think to be completely and totally revolted by a little bit of blood on a stick, but being able to be like arms deep in the blood of a cow, I feel like if your arm's deep in the blood of a human, which he may have been, then yeah, I feel like that's a cause for concern when there usually isn't. But I still think that even just that little bit, everybody seems to agree that was there, that he seemed to have overreacted.
All right. That's
even
fair.
For a normal person.
Because I think, like, you know, if you take out a, you know, if you get a steak or something, there's still blood in the steak. Yeah. So, I mean, that's, you know, and we don't get revolted to that. It's just, you know.
Yeah.
It's normalcy.
It's true.
But I think it, I mean, if there's a big chunk of hair, oh, man.
Oh, man. Oh,
oh gosh.
Anyway.
It's as if he cut off his thumb. There's just blood everywhere.
The other thing that struck the cop Lomasney as odd was that Potter was complaining about how cold he was, which is strange because Potter, again, worked with animals. He was up all times of day, all times of night, at all days of the year. He was pretty well accustomed to cold.
Whoa. You can be up all the time and still get cold.
No,
right?
You can get cold for sure. But again, so here's, let me paint the scene for you.
Now,
dude.
If he's not wearing the proper attire for there the type is, of weather, then there there's is, another issue he's having.
There is a dead man on the grass.
Yeah.
And everyone is like, oh no, Charles Walton, our friend and my family member, says Edith, is dead.
And Potter's
how horrible.
Over there is like,
and Potter's like,
I'm so
cold. And this is my land. What? And then the thing that really seemed to kind of put Lomasney off for good about Potter is that Potter then, after a little while, when they're like, ah, the detectives are coming. By the way, sorry about all the accents. It's just going to happen. He says, ah, the detectives are coming. And Potter says, well, I'm starving. I'm going to head on home.
Dude, nothing works up an appetite like murder.
Yeah, like staring. If you're so revolted by the sight of blood on a stick, and yet you're looking at this man with his throat slashed, and yet you're hungry.
Dude, I'm always hungry.
I'm just saying, something's not adding up there. And he just seemed to be getting more and more anxious. The more people arrived, the longer he was there.
You know what I bet sounded really good?
Huh.
Meat pie.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
I'm a horrible person.
Oh, no. Anyway, so he finally goes home right before the detectives get there. Everyone agrees that he's being a little weird. The next morning, around 7 a.m., Potter was spotted by another police officer prowling around the area the body was found. This is hard to point out as, like, evidence because it was his land. He does own this area.
Right.
And, you know, maybe he's going back to the scene of the crime to where they found the body.
Right, to cover things up.
You're right, or just to observe things. But in any case, the officer
right
says...
That's where I killed the man.
He's like standing there monologuing to himself. It's not Scooby-Doo. The officer says, like, hey, don't go over there. And Potter says, nah, it's fine. I found the body. I can go over there.
Nah, man, I've already seen this before.
And this is like totally
what
ironclad
was that
for that.
From?
I don't know.
We're gonna say things where it's unfortunate.
It's fine. It's fine. Yeah, so Potter goes back. He's gotten checking things out. The officer says, oh, don't go over there. He says, it's fine. This is my land and I found the body. And they kind of just stand there and talk for a little bit. And at this point, he brings up something that he hadn't mentioned before. He says to this beat officer in the morning, the relief officer, he says, oh, yeah, I touched that pitchfork.
Oh, yeah.
I totally touched the pitchfork that was in the neck of Charles Walton.
Were we not supposed to?
What?
Does that incriminate? What?
What?
Nah.
So, and then from there...
But he didn't disclose that to
He didn't to the... mention that the night before, no.
All right.
Little weird.
Huh.
Little weird.
He's probably like, oh, shoot. I left my fingerprints on there.
Ugh. Drat. Anyway.
We really have to stop
yeah,
this
we
kind
do
of accent
need
thing.
To stop.
I'm so sorry,
We're sorry, everyone. Now, the other thing that he immediately does is attempt to deflect again. He tries to deflect suspicion towards the Italian POWs over at Long Marston, which we had talked about before, how these people pretty much just roam the land.
Dude, if I'm ever a POW, I want to be a POW in Britain.
We need to fight the British Empire. That's what we need to do. Our whole lives
do
would
it.
Be fine.
Yeah.
Now, this is a bit of a theme with the Potters. They're consistently trying to blame others, even when no one else is trying to cast blame at the time. They, time after time, Jay.
Time after time.
Thank you. Now, on the 18th, Lomasney dispense.
What?
Lomasney decides to drop by the Potters unannounced. He arrived around 9:30 a.m.
That's quite rude.
Wow. It's the element of surprise. Okay.
But they're British.
What? He arrives around 9:30 a.m. and meets with Alfred's wife, Lillian. Now, Lillian had appeared to have been crying for quite some time, as her eyes were red and swollen. After just a few moments of small talk, Lillian broke into sobs. She claimed that she was just so worried that Alfred would be wrongly accused of the crime because he had no firm alibi for the entirety of the day. Now, Lomasny is then leaving the Potters when he comes upon Alfred, coming out of a barn. He claims that Potter was uncharacteristically quiet, and Lomasny tells Alfred to stop talking to his wife about the crime so much, as she was very upset by it. And Potter just kind of stands there and looks blankly at him. And at first, he
maybe
doesn't...
like he was about to murder him.
Well, it's just, it's unsettling, yeah. Is what it is. And at first, Lomasny's like...
about this murder.
He's like, just, you know, stop bringing up, you're freaking out your wife, man. Just cool it. And Potter just kind of looks at him. And then Lomasny leaves, and he's like, that was weird. And then it kind of clicks to him that it was almost as if Potter was about to break down into tears, and he was just trying to hold it back. Now,
that seems like a pretty weird emotional response if you did actually kill him.
Well, why?
You can, I don't know.
You
can
be
like,
sad about killing someone after
you
kill him.
So yeah, you can be sad about killing someone, but that kind of like emotional trauma? I mean, like, it's not like he accidentally killed him. It's not like he pushed him and he fell onto a rock or something and snapped his neck or something. It's a brutal murder.
Right,
This is not like, oh, I'm gonna hold back a little bit and just, you know, this is like, this is intense.
Yeah, but I feel like, I don't know. Have you never, obviously not murder, I'm not trying to like... I'm not an FBI informant or anything.
Sam,
here.
There's a reason why I had to move to Idaho.
Oh, no. haven't you ever done
tuition
something...
Tuition was way cheaper.
Have you never done something that you knew was wrong, but you did anyway, and then afterwards you felt bad about it?
Nope.
Really?
Nope.
Jason Moitoso.
Feel good about it. I got away with it. A little bad.
Yeah.
Little bad.
So imagine like, if the bad you had done was murder. Even if at the time it seemed like the best option, as time goes on, you're going to regret that. Because you have your different types of murders. I feel like so often nowadays we look at all murderers, not all murderers, but we kind of assume that most murderers are just sociopaths and they don't feel things normally, which is definitely true of a certain subset of murderers, of a lot of the serial killing variety. But I feel like the majority of murders are people driven by fear or by passion or by hate or by this or that to the point where they lose control. They end up killing someone.
Crime of passion.
Crime of passion.
Yeah.
They end up killing someone and then they feel guilt for it.
Yeah, they emotionally break down. That's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
So the clear and honest thing is just not get passionate about stuff.
Yeah.
Never be passionate.
Go the way of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Okay.
Proper centering.
Exactly.
Like it's great.
Nothing. I'm worried that Jason might be a sociopath. Anyway, now. Oh, God. That was a terrible face. Never make that face at me again. Stop. All right. Now. As time went on, Potter would confess to other things as well. And again, this is all, like, I think he's interviewed by the police two or three times, and then he's interviewed by Fabian two or three more times. And these all come out, like, one at a time.
He doesn't break down and confess.
He doesn't break down and confess. As time went on, Potter would also confess to touching the slash hook embedded in Walton's neck. He says that they come upon the body and Beasley, you know, Mr. Beasley, Edith's next door neighbor, he says to Walton as they're going back, as he's taking Edith away, he says, you better make sure that they're not still around here. And Potter says, oh, dang, you're right. So he goes to grab the slash hook, and then he's like, ah, that's really stuck in there. That's really stuck. It's really stuck in Charles Walton's neck. I'm just going to leave that there. But for this reason, his fingerprints may also be on the slash hook, but it's definitely not because he killed Charles Walton. Okay. Now, sure. This also... Uh-huh. This also was, of course, not reported on the night of the crime itself. Not even the day after. It was, I think, during one of the sessions with Fabian.
I mean, you can say it's shock. I mean, you it know, is the emotional trauma again. Like things, details slip.
It
you
is.
You forget about it until you can recollect later.
But I think one of the more interesting things is that he doesn't need an excuse for why his fingerprints are on
those
tools.
Are his tools. Like, they're his tools. He owned them.
Yeah,
his property. Yeah.
So. That you that's the whole problem
Unless
with and that's why we don't
are from blood.
Well, that's true.
Yes.
Yeah, that could be part of it. But the whole thing why we don't do true crime is because everything has two interpretations. The first is he says that because he's covering for himself and he just doesn't even put two and two together that, oh, they're his tools, so it's fine, it doesn't matter anyway, or he's scared. The second is just that you're right. He doesn't need an alibi. So he was being honest when he was talking about this for some reason. This is why we don't do true crime, because I'm not patient enough for it.
That's fair.
It's crazy. I'm proud of everyone who does do true crime. You're all great. But
back to our story.
Back to our story. Now, by the time that Fabian got down to the business of building a case and identifying suspects, Potter's name had been thrown about a number of times. And Fabian recalls being startled by what he had heard. He called the man in for further questioning, and more odd things began to turn up. Now, one of the first things that Fabian noticed about Potter was his succinctness with time. Basically, Fabian focused primarily on the day of the murder, and Potter could, down to the minute, give the accounts of his whereabouts.
That's weird.
Yep, he said, to the point of he was saying, like, one of the things he did was, I don't even know, it was like, smash... Mondrogues. I don't know what that means, but that's what he went to do.
Rock on, bro.
With his
what?
One of his farming neighbors, something like that.
Hopefully someone can clue us in.
And he says he like looks up at the clock precisely at 1 o'clock. And so I knew therefore that at precisely 1 o'clock I was in my neighbor's yard smashing mondrogues. And then I got out of rock on. And then I got out of the pub, and we went, or after that I went to lunch, and I remember looking at the clock tower right as I got home at 1:10, and then I remember looking at it right as I got out at 2:15 on the dot. And it's like this weird, like...
He's really good at doing stuff at 5-minute intervals.
Right, exactly. It's always just what? Right on time.
Yeah.
And no amount of leeway. He gives, like, three or four different... The accounts are all the same. The actual events are all the same, but it's just the timings and the patterns. He gives like three or four different patterns.
And he keeps saying exactly at these times. That's so weird.
Yeah, it's very strange.
I totally understand. Like, maybe like around 1:10, we started doing something else, or 2:15-ish.
Yeah, right around, around noon.
Yeah.
But he never talks like that. It's always like this specific time. He talks about spending the day...
Calm down.
He talks about spending the day working with his neighbor, like we said, smashing those mondrogues. He removes the corpse of one of his heifers from a creek, which it had been stuck in.
Yikes.
Yep. And then he spends the rest of his day.
How long
is it there for? I think it died the previous day.
Yeah.
Which will come into this.
Yeah.
And then he spent the rest of the day milking cows. So with his neighbor, that can be verified. Lunch... theoretically can be like verified at with his wife and all of that, getting the heifer. Right. I know, but theoretically could be verified there, getting the heifer. I think he had other people help him there.
Yeah,
what
I
he can't
assume so. It's, I mean, talking a few hundred pounds at least.
What he can't verify and what he has no one else to back him up for is right about 12:20 to 1 PM.
The witching hour.
Not necessarily the witching hour, but the time that Charles Walton died.
Ah!
Yes.
Ooh, I see the issue.
He has no alibi for this time whatsoever. But, of course, that's not evidence. That's just circumstantial.
Yeah.
To say the most about it.
Yeah.
So, they return again to the man that Potter claims to have seen working in the field. Potter again affirms that he had seen the man wearing his shirt sleeves. came to the conclusion that it had to have been someone other than Walton, but he didn't know who. And he did say originally that he was, I think, 500 to 600 yards away at that point, that he had seen like the form of the individual and kind of what he was wearing, which even that
500 to 600 yards away. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, even
you can't
that
tell what they're wearing at that
even
distance.
That stretches
they're,
the imagination.
They're like maybe a silhouette of a human. Like what?
I hear
maybe
you.
Maybe 500 to 600 feet.
I hear
yards.
You.
Yards. What?
That's what
no.
it said. I'm just telling
Dude, you
what
have,
it's
like,
saying.
Eagle vision or something Eagle to do that.
Now, finally, the conversation turns towards that of Charles Walton's finances. Now, his wife had died in 25, right? She had left him a tidy sum of £230. In today's money, that equaled £13,000. That inflation rate is insane.
Well, I mean, you're talking almost 100 years.
Ours, I think, is 18. Like, $1 back then is like $18 to $22.
Mm-hmm.
£1 back then is like 500 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like 50 pounds.
Still.
It's crazy.
That's a pretty high inflation.
It's huge. So, 230 pounds. In today's money, it's about 1,300 pounds, or 13,000 pounds, or about $17,000. Now, there had never been any substantial withdrawals from Walton's account. It just kind of evaporated to the point where Fabian was convinced that Walton had little by little pulled it out and put it somewhere else because his lifestyle did not even account
for
him.
That much money?
Yeah, and even the money that he made. He had an old age pension fund.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked for Potter.
Yeah.
And though that money combined...
Well, I mean, he didn't work a ton for Potter. It was still a little bit to do
that
stuff.
That money combined, I'm pretty sure his rent for like a week wasn't even a matter of pounds. It was a matter of like shillings. And he got paid... Oh, yeah, he got paid like 2 shillings a week or 2 pounds a week. So
wow.
He more than made up his stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. It like I said, money used to go far.
Yeah.
And then Oof. Someone ruined the economy.
Why do you act like I did?
Anyway.
How do you know I'm immortal? How do you know that I caused the stock market to crash back in the 30s?
Anyway.
It wasn't me.
It's like that Shaggy
yeah,
song.
Exactly.
But it's about crashing
the
world the
economy. Stock market.
Now, his lifestyle did not even account for that, and interestingly enough, he had only 2 pounds left in his account by the time he died.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Maybe he had a gambling problem.
It's possible, but again, if you talk to Edith...
But it's such a tiny little town, and what do you gamble
Yeah,
at?
493 people. Somebody's going to be like, I saw Charlie Walton. I'm going to stop doing accents. I saw Charles Walton gambling at wherever the heck people would gamble in this town. And again, according to Edith, he didn't go out with people.
Yeah, he didn't do anything.
He didn't go to the pub. Yeah. He didn't even drink. He didn't smoke.
So where is his money going?
That's the whole thing. And that's what Fabian is hoping to find out.
Okay.
He feels like if he can find this money, he can find the killer.
Hey, you can just spoiler alert it. Just where does he find it?
He doesn't find the money.
Oh my
the
gosh.
Money never what? Shows up.
Is this guy really the best Scotland Yard has?
Yes, he what? Really is. All he right. is Sherlock Holmes in his own little way.
Yeah.
Now,
all right.
Potter comes out. He's a strange man. Potter comes out and says, "No, I don't know anything about Charlie Walton's money, but what I do know is that I have been cooking my books."
Whoa! If we're talking about finances, I gotta be.
Let me just tell you. I'm embezzling. Basically, the way it would work is that, like we said, Walton works when he could. Sometimes
right.
that's 5 days a week. Sometimes that's 5 days a month. Regardless of how it shakes out, Potter would pay Walton every week according to the books.
Ah.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd that money go, Sam?
Any week that Walton didn't end up working or worked less than average, Potter pocketed the difference.
Oh, Potter.
And even with that, some weeks he ended up spending Walton's wages and having to delay paying him a few days to a week later.
What is he spending his money on?
I'm sure his is more of the booze. I'm pretty sure he was a pretty heavy drinker.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Now, this is significant for one main reason. If he just owns this farm, I mean, yeah, it's not great, but whatever. It's his farm. It's his money. It's whatever. He actually doesn't own this farm.
Ooh, who does?
His father owns the farm.
Oh, man.
So not only is he stealing from Walton on occasion, he's stealing from his own family fairly regularly. This admission, however minor it might seem in the grand cosmic scheme of things, in the mind of Fabian...
How long did he work for, Potter? 9 months?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if he skimmed anything on anyone else's. I'm assuming probably.
Well, what's weird is that...
Maybe previously.
What's weird is that, and we were going to get into this a little later, but we don't have that much on it. He didn't, as far as we can tell.
It was literally just taking advantage of
a nice old man.
Charlie while he was working there.
And for his part, theoretically, he always did end up paying Walton.
Right.
It was just a little late sometimes. Yeah. But they talked to other employees that Potter had, and everyone was like, no, I never had a problem with it. I never got paid late, never had my wages garnished or stolen or anything. He was a totally fine guy to work for, which is just a little strange. But
it's weird that he faltered then.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And
interesting.
As we'll see, Walton as well never mentioned this to anybody. It was of such a little concern to him that he didn't even think it needed to be brought up. Yeah. Here and there.
Weekly.
pretty often.
Yeah. That's pretty frequent.
Now, like I said, this admission moved Potter in the mind of Fabian, moved him from innocent to criminal by nature, and from being a bystander into a suspect. Yeah.
I mean, so yes, you're right.
Yes, he is a criminal.
Wonderful.
Now, the other thing is that people kind of talk about Potter as if he was a little slow, especially the police reports. They're like, he's fine. He's, I don't know if I'd say slow, just a simple guy, a normal, simple dude of normal intelligence, if even that. But Fabian believed wholeheartedly that Potter was putting on an act. He said he appears sudden, sullen, and slow, but he is most likely an extremely cunning individual and at least a moderately good actor.
That's a...
Put on a slow act for the detectives. But Fabian, of course, had been reading people for decades.
Playing dumb.
Yeah. Fabian knew how to look for traits and look for things like that. And he found it pretty well. Now, Fabian and Webb, his assistant, would go on to question every individual living in Lower Quinton, all 493 of them. Thousands of statements and pieces of paperwork constitute the Walton file. And we had mentioned last week that Walton had only one friend, an older gentleman by the name of George Higgins. There is the idea, often proven true, that people rarely get murdered by people they don't know, or even just know in passing. Usually people get murdered by people that they know very well, and it seemed as though Charles Walton did not know very many people very well. The only person who he knew who knew him was George Higgins.
Yeah, his walking buddy on Sunday.
His walking buddy.
Yeah.
Great old guy.
Higgins.
Now, the conversation with Higgins was necessary, but unfortunately did not yield much to go on. Fabian came away fairly certain that Higgins was not the murderer. They spent their time talking mostly about Charles Walton in general, not necessarily the crime or Higgins' whereabouts, this and that.
Ah, feeling it out.
Yes. According to Higgins, Walton didn't have a quarrel with anyone that he knew of. He had never spoken angrily of being cheated or anything like that. No one owed him money. He owed nothing to nobody. And Walton also, the other thing that Higgins said, Walton also never carried more than a few shillings on him at any time. So, of course, the other idea is maybe he did have a lot of money on him, and he kept his money on him all the time. It got stolen. Edith said this never happened. Yeah. Higgins says, I think his exact words were like, he would have had to change drastically to be the type of man to carry any sort of money on him at all. Now, here's the interesting thing about George Higgins.
Mm-hmm.
According to Fabian, he had the ability, he had the physical ability.
We're talking about Higgins.
Higgins.
Okay. had the ability to...
The older gentleman.
Yes.
I think he's even older than Walton. The Walton was 74. Oh, yes, man. The walking pal. Higgins had the ability physically and could have gotten to and from the murder site without being seen, essentially.
Would he have the physical strength to actually commit the murder?
He seems to think that it was possible.
Okay.
Fabian just says, though...
Higgins just lifts a lot.
Fabian just says, it wasn't Higgins. It's fine. Let's move forward. And I don't necessarily think that's wrong.
Yeah.
But it is interesting because you have, like, all of these things. He talks so much about the geometry.
You really don't have, like, much of a motive.
No, you have no motive.
Yeah.
Other than
Higgins, at least.
Potentially the cash, if he knew where the cash was or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, $17,000. That's a lot of money, right?
It is.
I don't know if I'd kill someone for it, but it's a lot of money. They talk so much about the geometry of this place. And, like, I am terrible at spatial reasoning, so I didn't really put any of that in here. Essentially, what it comes down to is from Higgins's barn, he could have seen Walton working in the field. He could have gone over to him, ducking behind things, killed him, and then gone back without pretty much being seen at all. But at the end of the day, it's just Higgins. What's Higgins gonna do? What? That doesn't make sense.
I don't know, unless, you know, Charles was, like, for some reason financing Higgins on some level.
There's some sort of conspiracy here.
But, I mean, if it goes dry, I mean, what is he gonna do? It's not like he can get more money out of him.
Right.
So, like, there's no reason to commit murder.
As we will talk about at the end.
Okay.
This is kind of my headcanon. I don't know why, but I just like the idea
that Higgins did
of Higgins doing it.
I don't know, man.
Because he is the only person with the opportunity, right? You have motive, potentially. Alfred Potter has set himself up for motive.
Oh, yeah. Motive. All
between the cash and the money and the stealing
had,
and the investment.
You know, if Charles had figured out that he was skimming money, then yeah, there's the motive right there. Easy.
And he had kind of the opportunity. Theoretically, it could work.
Yeah.
And then you have Higgins.
That beautiful time slot. Yeah.
Yeah, you have Higgins, who essentially had no motive, but had all the opportunity in the world.
Right.
It's
like me right now with you.
You're right. So that's kind of my headcanon. But anyway, we'll get into that a little further at the end. Now, basically at this point, after literally talking to everyone in town, Fabian says, I'm pretty sure it's Potter. And
who is he whispering that to?
He's whispering it to Webb, his assistant.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure it's Potter. But they knew that from a legal standpoint, if it got to the point, ideally when it got to the point that they could bring charges against Potter, if the defense was like, who else did you investigate? And he said, absolutely no one. That's not going to look great, you know?
Yeah.
So they do interview a few additional suspects, put some other people on the list, mainly as a formality. One of them was an army private stationed in Long Marston by the name of Thomas Davies, who was known as a guy, he was always trying to make a quick buck. He was a little skeevy. He was known locally as a varmint trapper.
Fun.
Yeah.
That's a great...
It's a noble profession. The day in question, he was laying traps and poison on a local farm. His alibi was verified by, I think, 6 other individuals, so he didn't do it. Another suspected individual was a local transient named Ginger, who had red hair and a red beard.
You don't say! You
don't say.
I'm shocked.
He would wander the area. He'd sleep in the fields. He'd do a little work for food or for lodging occasionally. And he had been seen wandering the fields on the morning of the murder. But that was just what Ginger did. He walked in the fields. Multiple people claimed to have seen him elsewhere between noon and 1 when the murder was supposed to have taken place.
Yeah, and I mean, plus, again, like, Charles is not known as a gentleman to wear or to have a lot of cash on him.
Right.
So
no real...
There's no real reason to murder.
And he's just not a, you know, Ginger just doesn't seem like
a murdering guy.
A murderer? You know? Just because he's a transient doesn't mean that he's a murderer, right?
Probably,
I would say. So, Ginger's out because he's a nice dude. Thomas Davies is out because he's killing rats elsewhere.
I love your detective skills.
Higgins is out because Higgins is out.
Yeah.
There's no other reason.
Naturally.
In addition to the 493 people living in Lower Quinton, over 400 servicemen who were on leave in the area that day were interviewed as well. Every single one of them were cleared. I know. It was a monumental undertaking.
Yeah.
There was a lot to this. They were there for
900 people interviewed?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
They were there for months. Yeah.
Yeah, you'd have to be.
Yeah. Anyway, meanwhile, Potter began to become more and more attractive as a suspect.
You don't say.
Clothes belonging to Potter that he had been wearing on the day of the murder tested positive for the presence of blood, although they had been so well cleaned that it was impossible to tell whether it was human or animal blood on the clothes.
Okay.
These were the clothes that Potter was wearing when they went out there. It wasn't just like he had put them in his hamper or something like that.
Yeah, so it was like he washed them.
Put them back on.
Who knows why. So that if someone saw him later in the afternoon,
they wouldn't be like, hey. Ah, he changed his clothes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Potter did it. I'm done. Wrap this one up and put a bow on it. We're all set.
While double-checking Potter's accounts of the days, like we said, there's like this 40 minutes where theoretically he could have gone out there, he could have murdered Walton, and then gotten back and washed his clothes. The interesting thing is that for some reason, Mrs. Potter says, my husband never washes his clothes in his life. He never washed those britches. And they were like, what? Why are you mentioning this? And she says, he never washes his own clothes.
Oh, so you...
She's like trying to throw...
helping him.
Something else at the alibi that just doesn't... So yeah, it's like, okay, so what does that have to do with anything? Well, he just never washes his own clothes. It's very strange. They just acted very weird, just
all
saying
right.
things yeah. like that all the time. No clothes. Now... On the 17th of March, Fabian and Webb decide to surprise Lillian Potter with a visit and an interrogation. She was nervous. She kind of said, oh, well.
It's like a pop quiz.
Yeah, she's like, Alf is out in the fields, and so I can go get him. And they were like, no, that's okay.
We want to talk to
you. Oh, you don't want to talk to Alf? No, we're good. Thank you. Let's talk to you. And she made it like 5 minutes, and then she had a huge breakdown and started crying. She
probably because she knows something.
She, like her husband, has an uncanny recollection for the specific times of things occurring. And here's one of them. She says something along the lines
of freaking guilty.
She says something along the lines of, well, and then I looked at the clock and I knew that it would be 40 minutes for me to make dinner, and then it would be another 40 minutes. I knew that from what time it was now, it would be 40 minutes for me to make dinner, and it would also be 40 minutes until Alfred comes home, and so that I should probably start making dinner. And then the detective said, what did you make for dinner? And she said, you know, I can't recall. I just remember the times I made dinner. I don't remember actually making dinner.
That's somewhat fair.
I guess
glancing over, be like, oh, Alfred's going to be home in 40 minutes, and dinner's going to take like 40 minutes to cook, so better start making dinner.
Let's make some dinner.
I don't remember what I ate last week.
It's true. It's
fair. For dinner. So, I mean, like, that's totally, I kind of get it.
I think it's, again, this whole idea of, because she is well rattled off specific times and stuff like that. That wasn't the only thing she said. It's this idea that they can remember down to the minute so precisely what they were doing, but then for like... a more memorable thing like what dinner was itself, that's where she has absolutely no idea, you know, which you would think it's like completely tied. Oh, it's going to take 30 minutes to make dinner because I'm going to make meat pies. I don't know what they eat. I'm going to make meat pies. And I know that meat pies take 30 minutes. It's like this sort of detail you would think would be ingrained with it, but it's just missing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like we mentioned before, the entire time, the police were also searching for that tin pocket watch of Walton's, hoping that it would turn up some usable blood or fingerprints that could count as evidence. However, unfortunately, it was not to be found during the duration of Fabian's investigation. Now, Fabian...
Yeah, that is a weird thing to go missing.
Yeah. Fabian spent days and days and weeks and weeks and months trying to crack the case and to crack Alfred Potter specifically. But everything that we talked about, everything that we've mentioned in the last hour or so, none of it is actual evidence against Alfred Potter. None of it can be used in a court of law. All of it is circumstantial to even say that. It's mostly just not evidence. It's just stuff that's not adding up. But there's no physical proof. And I think that this, doing this research, is one of the things that has helped me to understand better this idea of what is actual proof and what is not. And I hope to take that with me in my journeys as a ufologist and all of that. But all of this is just conjecture, to say the most. You know, his fingerprints aren't found. His blood isn't found.
Wait. His fingerprints aren't found.
His fingerprints are found a lot, but they're not found on Charles Walton. Walton has defensive wounds. They don't match up with Potter at all, or Potter's hands or anything like that. But not only was Potter never convicted, he was never arrested, he was never charged, and no one ever would be. This case is the longest standing on the Warwickshire records as being a unsolved murder. Fabian believed to the end of his days that someone was going to come forward with something.
Yeah, whether, like on their deathbed or something.
Whether it was the watch or a deathbed confession or this or that. There was another story that he chased up pretty well of a Italian prisoner who was acting suspiciously during the day, and he was seen by two or three different people, but and it was like he was seen walking very quickly away from the area where away from the area where Walton's body would be found, and having a look of panic on his face. And he was seen by two or three different people, but no one knew who this guy was. There was hundreds of Italian prisoners of war at Long Marston. No one was able to identify anyone for sure. And because their records were so lax, it was also impossible to say, like, oh, these 20 people were out of camp when this happened. They didn't know. They didn't know who was in camp and who was out of camp. So this case never gets solved for good. And never gets solved by Fabian, which is something
that's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's something that sticks with him to the day he dies. Essentially, he writes two different memoirs.
Yeah, it's the one that got away.
Pretty much. He would write of it in two different accounts, two different memoirs, two different volumes. In the first one, he's like, it was kind of witchy. It was a little witchcrafty.
Yeah.
In the second one, he's like, this was witchcraft. What's interesting,
I think he was probably dwelling on this a little bit too long then.
I think so. I think it's true. But he has one specific event that happens, and it happens, as far as I know, it was shortly before he left the village. Other people say it was right as soon as he got there, this and that. It's in his memoir somewhere, but I just couldn't track him down. Anyway, he's up on the top of Meon Hill,
mm-hmm.
and he's looking down, just like the devil was doing last episode. And he says to himself, like, there's a killer down there, and I have to find them, but I can't find them. And suddenly this big black dog appears on top of a nearby wall, and it just stands there.
A dog on a wall?
Yeah, a dog on a wall. The wall, I don't think,
is
was
it like
very
a short
large.
Little like broken down like, wall kind of a thing? Okay, yeah. Okay.
I think it was like 2 feet tall. You okay. know, they
yeah,
have
yeah,
those,
yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And also it's ruins. So it was probably
like
a foundation.
It's like the little
wall
that the Drover Demon was on.
The Dover Demon.
Dover.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That thing.
Now, suddenly, a large black dog appears on the top of a nearby wall, and the dog appears to study Fabian for a few minutes and then trot away. Now, right after this, a young boy enters the field a moment later, and Fabian asks him if he's looking for his dog. The boy says, "What dog?" And Fabian begins to describe it simply by saying, "A big black dog," at which point the boy looks completely spooked and runs away. The next day, a big black dog, possibly the very same that Fabian saw on top of Meon Hill, was found hanging from a bush right where Charles Walton's body was found.
Mm-hmm.
According
what?
According to Fabian, although what? although he is a rationalist, he doesn't believe in the actual power of witchcraft. That's an important thing to remember.
At what point does a bush become big enough to become a tree?
Right? I feel like this
hanging
dog
from
was
a bush?
On a tree.
What?
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
Fabian is not, he doesn't believe in the magical power of witchcraft. He doesn't believe in the actual ability to affect change on the material world through magic ritual. Mm-hmm. What he does believe is that the power of the mind has so much to do. He describes in his memoirs sneaking into places to observe black magic rituals and things like this and seeing them do horrible things, even though, of course, it didn't bring them power. It didn't bring them what they wanted. It didn't stop them from doing the things themselves. And he says that at this moment, as he's staring at this dog hanging dead, he says, at this moment, I realized for certain we were up against witchcraft.
Oh my goodness.
And the official case files...
So weird.
I know. The official case files have a quote from Fabian as well. We'd mentioned this wall of silence that he kind of came up with, right? Came
How
up
was
against.
That dog hanging?
They probably...
By, like, its neck?
Yes.
Oh. So, like, it got a collar stuck in it?
I don't think so, dude. I think someone murdered the dog.
Why would you do that to a puppy?
Yeah, I
that
agree.
That makes zero sense.
Fake news. This didn't happen because no one would ever actually hurt a dog.
No, they shouldn't.
I agree. Now, like we mentioned last week, Fabian kind of came up with this, or came against this wall of silence, right? And in his official case files, Fabian makes a note describing the mood of those he encountered. He says, and I quote, "We made our investigation in the village from door to door. There were lowered eyes, reluctance to speak, except of talk of bad crops, a heifer that died in a ditch. But what had that to do with Charles Walton? Nobody would say." And that's important because that takes place before he dwells on it for the rest of his life.
Okay.
He makes that note as he's in town. Now, in another one of his writings, Fabian recalls knocking on the door of an elderly gentleman, someone who, for all intents and purposes, was completely unremarkable to the case, simply fishing for information. The man opens the door, and Fabian starts speaking by saying, "I'm inquiring about the late Charles Walton," but he's cut off. And the man responds, "He's dead and buried for a month now. So what are you worried about?" And then slams the door in his face.
Wow, that's a cynical old man.
I don't know if it's cynical as much as it's sinister. That's not the normal. Because the normal idea, I mean, I don't know if... Like, okay, remember the frickin' clown thing that happened?
Oh yeah, that was awful.
Yeah, right? It was awful, even though nothing was actually happening for the most part. Like, yeah, there were a few weirdos. But people were, like, locking their door and going crazy and, like...
Oh yeah, a few clowns got shot.
Yeah, people got shot over this.
And then people stopped being clowns. Hey, that's the way you take care of business.
That's the way life works. But what I'm trying to say is that even though there's no evidence that those clowns ever actually murdered anybody or even were as many places as they said they were,
yeah,
people freaked out.
Oh, yeah.
In town where there is an actual murderer, where this person has not been caught after he brutally murdered an old man, people are like, what are you worried about? Go home. Forget about it. And this is a
That's village fair, because you think, like, thing. With such a small community that this would make a bigger impact.
You'd think it would be a bigger impact, and you'd think that more people had more things to say.
Right.
They would answer questions directly put to them, but they would never volunteer information. And another off-repeated anecdote from Fabian's case files was a conversation that he had overheard. I can't remember if he was in a pub or in a market or just on the road, but essentially he hears a man speaking with someone else, and they're talking about the poor crops of the year previous. And then Fabian hears one of them say, "Yes, but Charles Walton is dead and in the ground, so what does it matter now?" And it's just this, like...
That's weird.
It's this sinister little thing. Now, Fabian finally returns back to London after a matter of months. Like I said, by the time his second volume of memoirs comes out, whether he believes in the objective power and reality of black magic itself, the Charles Walton murder in his mind ends up firmly fixed as being connected to the occult in some way or another. It's very strange. So we have Fabian.
It's weird.
We have Fabian's investigation, the good science-y, detective-y investigation, which came up with nothing at all.
Yep, and then he turned to supernatural.
Turned to the supernatural after it.
He said, "Thank you, Sherlock Holmes."
Thanks.
Whatever.
Well, you know Arthur Conan Doyle. Arthur Conan Doyle was a huge. He loved the supernatural.
I didn't.
He
know.
Loved
Did
ghosts.
You know him?
I hate you. Anyway,
the seance. We'll just talk to him right now.
No, he'd probably show up. He seems like someone who would show up for that.
Then we call upon Hemingway after that. I want to see what that guy's all about.
He was sad. Let him be. Anyway, now Fabian does his thing, and he did it pretty well. But he was by no means the only person to investigate this case. And despite his openly speaking about its connection to witchcraft, he was also not the only person, or even the loudest person, to talk about the occult in connection to this case. And we're going to get forward with the story here in just a moment, but we are going to take a brief break for our sponsors. Now, you've heard me talking about Videoblocks.com for a few weeks now, but they have outdone themselves again and come out with a brand new offer for the listeners of the Not Alone podcast, valid for this holiday season only. Now, for the same price that you'd pay to access Videoblock's huge library of stock video footage, you now get access to all three of the Storyblocks media libraries. Now, that's right, for just $149, you can get access, all the access to your heart's content of not only video, but also stock audio and still image content, all included in that one price of your subscription, essentially tripling the value of your Storyblocks subscription. You're going to be able to get literally hundreds of thousands of images, audio, and video clips, all included with the price of that subscription, as well as huge discounts on any premium clips, anything out of their creator libraries. And you can feel good about it because anything that you do end up paying for, that money goes right into the pocket of the creator themselves. Using the Storyblocks.com media libraries, there is no reason that your production has to look anything less than the absolute best it can. Everything from B-roll footage to entire sound theme scores for your production are all available under this amazing deal at this amazing price. But it's only good through the holiday season, only good through December. So make sure you jump over as soon as you can. As soon as you hear this message, just open it up on your smartphone, tablet, desktop, laptop, Apple Watch, I don't care. Just go to videoblocks.com/notalone. That's videoblocks.com/notalone. I guarantee it's not only worth your time, it's worth your money, and it is going to take your production from being a amateur labor of love, well-intentioned, but definitely a hobby, and make it into something that can compete and stand out from the crowd of other independent content creators out there. So head on over. Again, that's videoblocks.com/notalone. I guarantee it's worth it. All right, let's get back to the show. One Ms. Margaret Murray became...
Oh, this lady.
Dude, she's awesome. I love her. I think she's great. She became interested in the case, and I'd mention she's famous for another case kind of like this that we probably will be covering. It's commonly referred to as Bella in the Witch Elm, which it is another like witchcraft killing that we'll probably look at in a few months once this is washed off our palates. But she, more than anybody else, is the main reason that this idea of witchcraft has presided or existed to this present day in connection to this case. Now, she was a prominent anthropologist who stood out particularly in the field of Egyptology. She was also deeply invested in and fascinated with the study of witchcraft, and she has published a number of works on witchcraft, including one which is titled The God of the Witches. And her first work on this, which was called simply The Witch Cult in Western Europe. Now, she was a renowned academic, and although she did back some incorrect theories, as we'll be talking about, she should be taken as such. She has been hailed as one of the earliest women to make a serious impact on the world of professional scholarship. She was known as the first person to look at the witch trials through a feminist view, from a more human view, instead of the actual, like, just religious side of it. She was a scholar, but that one of those things that she got wrong pretty prominently is this theory that's known as the witch cult hypothesis, which is pretty interesting, even though it's pretty well accepted to be incorrect.
Yeah, it was disproven like within the decade she published it.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty cool, though. I'm going to tell people about it.
Yeah, it's a neat one. I read a little bit on it. It was interesting. Yeah. I was just like, all right.
The witch cult hypothesis speculates that the existence of another religion, a polytheistic one that focused its worship primarily on a horned god that, much like Jesus Christ, died and was resurrected. This cult was a secret society running parallel with the development of mainstream Christian society in Western Europe, particularly in the British Isles. Now, the witch trials of the Middle Ages in Europe, according to this theory, were an attempt by Christians not to suppress a quote-unquote satanic cult in the typical terms of Satanism, as in opposition to God through the powers of the devil, but rather as an idea to try to stomp out this witch cult that had their own deity, their own worship system, that really, for all intents and purposes, wanted to be pretty much left alone and to worship the way they wanted to worship. But this is why those witchcraft hearings and trials and the Malleus Maleficarum and all of that came out, was because of this secret cult.
Yeah, and that idea is interesting, but it comes down to the point where it's like, you know, you don't talk about Fight Club. Well,
right.
You talk about Fight Club. It just happens.
It gets out.
So it would get written down somewhere, because the nice thing about Christianity is that it has always kept fairly good records of stuff. That being said, you know, there's being skewed of particular facts, but they do a good record keeping.
Right, right. And this witch cult does not.
Does not pop up anywhere.
No academic, like, there is no actual, just like Alfred Potter, there's no hard proof that this happened. And a lot of people say that the reason that Murray backs this and the reason that she's wrong about this is because she's not trained in the study of Western Europe. She's trained in Egyptology.
Yeah, so Eastern.
The way that she sees things and the way that she looks and the lens that she does it through is through that Eastern lens. If she looked through the Western lens, she never would have come up with this. But who knows, one way or the other. It's interesting stuff. I'll probably try to read, like, that book called The God of the Witches, which just sounds...
That sounds dope.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet. Now, it was Margaret Murray who, in 1950, took back up the cause of the Walton case, this time from a pretty much straight-up witchcraft point of view, as you might guess. She went to the village of Lower Quinton, posing as an artist. Murray would work Walton into casual conversation, claiming to have heard of him from here or there, but not really know much about the crime itself. And she published her findings in the Birmingham Post. Now, she points to the murder of Charles Walton as undeniable truth of the witch cult theory. Her exact words from the article published in that Birmingham Post are as follows, quote, "I think there are still remnants of witchcraft in isolated parts of Great Britain, and I believe that Charles Walton was one of the people sacrificed. I think this because of the peculiar way in which he had been killed. His throat had been cut and a pitchfork had been used after he was dead to prevent him from being moved. The sacrifices are carried out by people who still believe in a religion practiced in Britain before Christianity, whom we would call devil worshippers. They still practice black magic. The belief is that if life is taken out of the ground through farming, it must be replaced by a blood sacrifice. I am not interested in I am not interested in the murder, only in the witches. I think it was a murder without normal motive. No money was missing, and there was no other reason why the old man should have been killed. Unquote.
That's interesting, because she doesn't bring up the cross.
She doesn't bring up the cross, which is interesting because no one really brings up the cross.
So, has that been a fallacy that was
the way that it,
over time?
The way that it works, according to a few different sources, the cross itself is never written down anywhere. And okay, that's fair. In the case files, even I don't think in Fabian's memoirs, and it's not in the autopsy report or anything either. However, according to people, and again, it's hard to check your sources. It's hard to check follow up on everything when it's 70 years ago.
Well, I mean, why would the authorities make detailed notes about that? They did it on everything else.
So the idea, where the cross comes in is that it's not, for whatever reason, recorded by any of the authorities, but it is reported by the three witnesses. People say that Edith, Ann Potter, and Beasley all told them that there was a cross and all mentioned that there was a cross, but there's no written record of the cross itself.
Ah, so a cover-up.
Right, right. That's what it comes down to. Now, and there are so many different misconceptions in this, where again, just like I was saying earlier about Potter talking about how he touched the stuff,
yeah,
there's so many different sides here. Like, well, is it a cover-up or is it a lie? It's a problem. But who knows, right? We can't, this far out, we can't know for sure.
We can't verify anything. Pretty much. Everyone is dead.
Yeah, everybody who was there on that day is dead. Anybody in the town around it, there might still be a few people who were kids.
Yeah, but, kids at that point in time.
But that would be it.
But no one that was, like, visibly there.
Mm-hmm. Now, there have been others who tried their hand at solving the Walton case in the years to come, including the 16 members of the Birmingham Psychic Society, who held a seance in order to contact Walton. They conducted the seance at the site of the murder, and the medium there stated, speaking as Charles Walton, "I forgive, I forgive. I deserved what was coming to me, but not in such a brutal way." And the final witness, or otherwise investigator, is one of the most colorful and direct of all. People dance around the witchcraft angle.
You don't say.
People are a little reluctant to actually come out and say it, other than Murray. People are reluctant to come out and say, murdered by witches. Other than this person, who I enjoy. On the 19th of February, 1956... a paper called the Reynolds News published a story about the murder. The informant, who spoke on the condition of anonymity, stated that Charles Walton was in fact murdered by a coven of witches. The killing blow was struck by a woman who had been brought by a car from somewhere else, and this woman knew it because she was there.
Oh man, that Uber driver.
She was a member of the witch cult. And she had intimate knowledge of the ceremonies that took place. She claimed to have been scalped upon her defection from the cult.
That's hardcore.
Right? She even went on to reveal the identity of the mystery woman who had done the actual killing of Charles Walton, and this brushes us up against the superstar of the occult and paranormal that we name-dropped a few times before, Mr. Aleister Crowley. Now, Crowley was labeled the wickedest man in the world by the press, and he could have been many things. It's very hard to tell for sure. Like I said, eventually he'll be probably our first biographical subject on the show, but he could have been a very powerful magician. He could have been a con man.
Yeah, that one.
He could have been a philosopher and a keeper of ancient wisdom.
I like the con man aspect.
He could have been a German spy. He could have been a British spy.
Which is all what con men are.
He did own a curry restaurant.
Cover up.
He was many things. And he was many things to many people. But he had had a romantic relationship with the woman who buried the slash hook into Charles Walton's throat.
Ooh!
The woman's name was Deirdre McAlpine. And she was the mother of Crowley's son. According to the unnamed woman, she was the head of the cult, and they had murdered Walton for the purposes of human sacrifice. The informant, as speculated by Simon Reed in his book The Case That Foiled Fabian, which again, if this interests you at all, go buy that book. We'll have it in the link for the episode. The Case That Foiled Fabian. According to Simon Reed, he states that she was most likely a Birmingham resident named Sarah Jackson, who in June of 55 told her story to the Sunday Pictorial, and she claimed that she was, essentially, she had escaped from a witch cult at that point. And then she brought it back up next year. And then I'm sure she probably brought it up again.
Why, if you escaped from a cult, why would you keep talking about it?
And why, if they're, Simon Reed says this exact thing, why, if they're happy to kill Charles Walton, are they not killing you?
Yeah.
Like, it's some just not even.
Random old man versus a defective.
If we need proof that she is mistaken.
Yeah.
Or at the very least that she wasn't there when Walton was killed. We can take the proof in the fact that she claimed in her original article about it, she claimed that Walton was a shepherd who had been murdered at the stroke of midnight in a black mass in the middle of a circle of stones, and that the murder of Anne Tennant had also taken place on Valentine's Day. So those are four pretty big things that aren't true.
I'm sorry, Miss Jackson, you're just not true.
You're not for real. The proponents of the witchcraft theory are varied, from people like Fabian, who is reputable to skeptics, to Margaret Murray, who is a little more reputable to those who fall in a little more of the believer side of things, to people like Jackson, who is not reputable at all. Now, there are two pieces of evidence that take this back into the realm of being a little bit strange. The first one is Anne Tennant. Like we said, Anne Tennant was murdered in September 1875, I believe, in the village of Long Compton.
Mm-hmm.
Anne Tennant was murdered because she was a witch, theoretically. I'm not saying she was actually a witch, but who had used an evil eye to bewitch her neighbor, to put him under a spell or to kill his cows or this or that, his pigs, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
Anne Tennant may have been. It's not confirmed, but there is more than enough evidence for it to be a little strange. Anne Tennant may have been Charles Walton's grandmother. That's a little weird.
Yeah.
That's a little weird, isn't it?
That's a little weird.
Especially there's the idea that she's his direct grandmother, and then the idea that it's like by a marriage. And that they're not actually like related by blood.
Yeah.
Right. But at the end of the day, if you trace his genealogy, that's pretty much where it ends up.
Interesting.
So that in and of itself is more than a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Remember the watch?
Yeah.
The tin pocket watch?
Did it finally pop back up?
The tin pocket watch showed back up, I believe it was 5 years later. It showed up in 1950, and it showed up in an outhouse on the property. It was like hanging on a nail in the outhouse, in the property. And this outhouse had, of course, been searched and also just straight up used by people. It was found when they were demolishing it to make renovations and stuff like that.
Yeah, doing something else.
When they opened this pocket watch, which had some sort of inscription, some sort of marker, because there was an inscription on the tin watch that we didn't go over. It's the same watch, though, for sure. They open it, and they find a little colored piece of glass. And
okay, just a tinted piece of glass?
A tinted piece of glass. And when shown to the inhabitants of the village, it was a group of workmen who discovered it.
Mm-hmm.
And they essentially were like, hey, what the heck is this? What's this glass doing in here? Everyone who saw it was like, I know what that is. Without even knowing, Walton's pocket watch, they say, I know what that is. That's witch glass. That is glass that is kept on the person at all times to absorb or deflect the evil eye and magic energy. That's what it is.
I don't believe it.
And I looked it up, and witch glass is a thing. It's a real thing.
Oh, man, that's great.
That's
ridiculous.
This makes no sense to me. None of this makes any sense to me whatsoever. But at the end of the day, that's true. Okay.
Well, how do we know if it's true? Do we have a confirmation?
I mean, we don't have pictures, no. But we do have multiple sources talking about it.
Do we still have the pocket watch? Do we have it popped up anywhere else?
I don't know. All I know...
Did the Potters get it?
I don't think the Potters got it.
We just have a story that a work crew
I think the Potters actually died shortly, like 2 years after. I could be wrong.
Both of them?
No. First Alfred.
Oh, okay.
And then Lillian. I think I could be completely wrong about that.
Probably because he was so sad about the guy that he murdered 2 years previous.
It's totally possible. In any case,
drank himself to death.
You're right. We don't know because I'm not holding the pocket watch in my
exactly.
hand. But we have multiple accounts of the pocket watch and the glass inside.
All right.
So,
sure.
With that in mind.
All right. I'll keep it in mind.
What happened here, Jason?
What happened here?
What happened
Dude,
here?
What do you mean? What do you mean what happened here?
Tell me your theory. That's the whole point of a true crime show, I'm pretty sure, is to talk about theories.
It's obvious. Potter's the only one that had motive. He didn't have an alibi at the time. He was strong enough to do the murder. I think Potter did it.
Okay.
I don't think it was like a crime of... Possibly a crime of passion.
Well,
but I don't think
just,
it was like a crime of opportunity.
It's just interesting that... And I think that that's a good explanation. I really do. But to me, it's really interesting that Potter doesn't... Like, that he's murdered with his own stuff. Charles Walton is murdered with the things he has on him.
Yeah, it's like, again, more of a crime of passion than anything.
I guess. Maybe they like went out, he was like chatting with him, and then he was like, hey, where's my money, or something like that.
I know you've been skimming, yada yada, maybe something
okay.
like that.
All right.
Popped up somewhere in the conversation, and then an argument broke out, and then, well, you beat an old man with his own cane.
Yeah.
And then slash his throat.
And then you get really upset by it later. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. That's all you got to say about that? You got anything more about that?
About the murder, yeah. Witchcraft, though, I've got a little bit more. So
oh, yeah.
What do you think?
Okay, yeah, because you were going to talk about witchcraft.
Yeah, a little bit.
All right, we can do that. What do I think? I think I have two theories.
Uh-huh.
The first one
uh-huh.
is Potter did it.
Yeah.
The second one.
Is that a cult
the
of
second
witches?
One,
what do you call a flock of witches?
A coven.
A coven, there you go.
The second theory...
A flock, that makes sense.
Thank you. The second theory is that the village of Lower Quinton
has a deep, dark secret.
Has a deep, dark secret. It's something akin to, we talked about it before, but there's this great, so there's this podcast that I recommend everyone listens to, and it's from, we've talked about it before, it's from Dark Myths. It's called A New Winter, and it's an audio drama. It's super great about like a little town, and he's English as well, or mm-hmm. he's British, a little town. With a secret, and the secret has something to do with monsters. I don't know. I'm not all the way caught up.
Okay.
But.
There's something going on.
In my head canon, right, which I know is probably not the case, but it's possible. This whole town notices. We should write a movie. This whole town
totally.
Notices their crops are dying, right? The other thing that Fabian brings up is the heifer that died in the ditch.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the day before, which was Potter's heifer. So even if Potter killed him, you still have the idea that he killed him because of witchcraft. But this whole town has seen just bad harvests, seen bad things happening, and whether for better or for worse or for true or for false, much like the witch prickings of old, they decide on a witch. And they decide to blow off some steam and to get rid of the witch.
Oh, you mean the bleedings?
The bleedings, yes. And the witch is Charles Walton. And then, okay, so that's step one of the plan.
Okay.
Step two of the plan is who's the one person who wouldn't kill Charles Walton?
His niece.
George Higgins.
Oh, okay.
Higgins did kill Charles Walton.
You think Higgins killed
He had
Walton.
The motive. If we look at it this way, this gives him the motive. And the opportunity.
What was Higgins' farm? You said he had a barn.
Yeah.
But like, what did he do?
I don't know.
He's probably
he was
an old
Higgins.
Man. He's probably
He's
retired.
An old man. He's retired now.
Someone
he
else
walks on Sundays.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's the extent of our knowledge about Higgins.
Exactly. Because Fabian was like, oh, it's not Higgins. So why even bother? So he had the opportunity the whole time. He also has no alibi. And now he's got the motive. So essentially the whole town convenes and they decide to murder Charles Walton and they have George Higgins do it because they know that he's the last person he'd ever suspect.
And then no one says a
no one ever talks.
The entire
no one ever
wow.
talks.
Because for the next 70 years
because
of
the magic.
Because
yes.
of the magic.
Yes.
Did you see what their crops were like the following year?
I think they were probably fine, I want to say. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty
that
sure
would be,
they were okay.
That would be your answer.
So that's my headcanon.
It's beautiful. All right. It's beautiful.
You want to talk about witches?
Sure, I'd love to talk about witches. Because for the most part, witches, being generally female, there's an interesting...
There are male witches. Let's just make sure.
Generally female, okay. though. All that's right. That's when witches were essentially, right. like all the witch hunts during... the medieval times and periods, essentially that especially happened after the Black Plague.
Right.
Is mostly associated with female witches. And I watched a couple documentaries, a little bit more homework on it, and it's interesting that witches were generally kind of like the medicine men of pre-male god religions in a lot of ways. So
even post, I mean...
Yeah.
You have a lot of, and I think we may have mentioned it in some episode or another. I remember seeing it, like, this idea that there was this woman down the road who was a witch, and she was a witch because she knew what herbs to give people.
Yeah,
and which, everyone was which, totally fine with
witch
it.
Witch previously is a part of witch is wise. So a witch first was, like, meant to be as, like, a wise woman is essentially what it was connected to. So, yeah, you have essentially, like, healers, people of, women of power in the community. And then we had a transition into a male-oriented god with the Hebrew religion and then later on Christianity. And there's a lot of pretty clear evidence that it's unfortunate to say, but the witch persecutions were really to, well, put men above women.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, it came down to that. And I mean, it was funny, like a few months ago, I saw this thing pop up on Facebook that was talking about like how we view witches in pop culture now with broomsticks and black cats and their hats. Well, those were actually features of women that owned their own breweries, brewed beer at home,
ooh.
Black cauldron and everything.
Okay.
That was essentially how they brewed beer, and then they used...
And therefore they were industrious.
They used pointy hats in order to stand out in marketplaces. A broom above their doorway showed that they were open for business, and they had beer to sell, and they had cats in order to keep away the vermin from, you know, the barley
beer.
And everything. So it makes a lot of sense, and then after a period of time, men wanted to dominate the industry more and more heavily, so... That woman over there that owns her own business
right.
and lives by herself,
right?
She's a witch.
Right.
That's the only way she can do that.
I think that's fair.
So that's a lot of the witch hunt kind of essence over time in the, you know, post-medieval era. And it's weird when you look farther back because there's always this, like, weird pagan-ish, like, sacrifice thing involved
right.
with witches, which I mean, witches, if you're thinking about it, if they're all satanic and it's all about the devil,
right?
Yeah, sacrifices make some sense, but nothing involving Christianity really comes down to blood sacrifices.
So
yes,
one thing about it, you're right,
because pagan religions are the ones that get associated with sacrifices of some sort,
right? So one thing about it is that I think even Fabian himself, but multiple people who have gone to black masses and things like that, of course, never actually see kids sacrificed, right?
Right.
I'm sure one
babies
day we're going to talk
sacrifice.
About...
The devil isn't there to have a massive orgy.
I'm sure that one day we will talk about how, like, the Satanic Panic and how that was as a nation, but we're not going to do that today. But the entire idea is that it is not necessarily... non-Christian, but distinctly anti-Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, you would take, whereas in a normal, like, Catholic or even Christian service, you would take communion, right? The bread and the wine and the body and the blood.
Yeah.
You do this, but they do it with, and I don't know how, and I don't really care to know how, they say that the bread and the wine is soiled. And that you, instead of drinking the flesh or eating the flesh of Christ and drinking his blood, you are eating the flesh of the devil and drinking the devil's blood. And it's this sort of morphing. So while no one is actually seeing babies get
right, it's murdered. It's the kind of the reflection in the mirror.
Yes, exactly. So whereas in Christianity, the prevailing thought is that all life is sacred and this and that. Mm-hmm. The exact opposite of that would be murdering a baby. And mm-hmm. that's why it kind of fills in the gaps there. But
yeah, and yeah, it's also interesting to see like witches being painted as all these things, because it is right. It's, you know, the basics of like some pagan cultures, sacrifice, and then it builds up to being really kind of any woman that has any sort of power or, you know, independence from their mm-hmm. husbands or men in general. So it's interesting to see them kind of become almost like a scapegoat for whatever is not necessarily going with the flow of society, mm-hmm. being, oh, that's much be witchcraft.
Yeah.
I also looked very briefly, because I had an idea at work. I wanted to see like what cultures in England, essentially pre-Christian cultures that actually mm-hmm. did human sacrifice. Mm-hmm. To this date, archaeologists have not found one.
Oh, really?
All that's pre-Christian Anglo-Saxon pagan cultures did not do human sacrifices. They did do sacrifices for like fertility of land and stuff, but oxen, I guess, were the most common used, and other smaller creatures as well, but not human. And then after that, I also started thinking, well, what cultures did Anglo-Saxons and English culture get influenced by as well? Well, obviously, Viking culture.
Oh, yeah.
During the raids, and thus afterwards. So now the fun thing about...
Now, did the Vikings have human sacrifice?
Yes.
Because I remember watching Vikings.
Vikings absolutely did have human sacrifices, but the weird thing was is when Vikings did sacrifices, they did things in nines, which is weird. So, like, for example, when, like, blessing a temple or asking for a good favor at a temple, they would sacrifice 9 males of different species.
Okay.
And it wasn't necessarily like one human or two humans, but it was 9 males in general. 9 was one of their like kind of like sacred numbers.
Okay.
It's like, you know, hitting all 7s on jackpot.
Right, right.
It's kind of that kind of idea to it. So it's interesting to see that it took after Christianity had already arrived
mm-hmm.
for a new influence to come around to bring about the idea of human sacrifice to the British Isles. Which is interesting, because before that, yes, human sacrifice in mainland Europe was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So it's interesting, like, what... So did Christianity bring that idea over originally, or was this an influence that we got from the Viking raids that occurred in England? It's kind of weird, kind of fun to talk about and think about.
I really like... I'm a big fan of the magical thinking, like I'm very much like Fabian. I don't personally believe that like magic can influence the natural world, but I do believe that people can believe that it can, and then from there do these things. So I'm always very fascinated to see like, okay, where does this belief come from? Are there any actual documented cases of people performing a ritual and then seeing anything happen? Because at the same point, you have the idea that these people wouldn't continue to do this over the thousands and thousands of years if something wasn't happening.
I mean, let's be honest, but Christianity stamped out a lot of other religious cultures.
It's true.
Throughout Europe.
It's
so
true.
I mean, the Christianity was a huge wave that took over.
Oh, yeah. But I'm talking more of like, even to this day with things like modern new age ideas of magic and Wicca and things like that. So I'm not here to, especially with more modern things, like we're not here saying like, oh, if you practice Wicca, you're a witch who murdered Charles Walton. Like, that's not where we're coming from at the least. We understand there's all sorts of different beliefs, but I'm just, that sort of stuff has always interested me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I like learning about witches. I love learning about witches.
That's really fair, man.
And just as a quick plug to our good friend Nate Hale over at The Conspirators, his episode that just came out, today's Monday, I think it came out today, is called, like, The Last Witch.
people are going to be hearing this on probably Thursday.
I know, but I'm saying so. Today as in Monday.
Okay.
It's called, what's it called? I think it's called The Last Witch, and it's the story of the last person who was tried for witchcraft, which took place in 1944. So that's actually a lot quicker. In England.
No.
Yeah. So it's, let me take a look here.
You couldn't murder a person for, or you couldn't send someone to the gallows for being a witch.
I'm not saying
like 1848.
I'm not saying that they were sent to the gallows by any means.
Okay.
I'm just saying this is the last, it's the last witch trial.
That's so, oh man, that's so crazy to think of.
Here, let me read this little, I'm going to read this. I think Nate's going to be okay with this. England's official, this is the show notes for it. England's official laws regarding the prosecution of witches date back to the 1600s. Those laws would be responsible for the persecution and deaths of at least 4,000 people in the Middle Ages. Those very same laws would also remain on the books until well into the 20th century. In 1944, a psychic medium named Helen Duncan would gain notoriety by becoming the last woman to be tried under England's witchcraft laws. That sounds pretty fascinating. I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes.
I hope HBO picks that up and runs with it.
Dude, I think...
I'd love a true detective about that.
Oh, dude, True Detective is so good.
They're coming back.
The first season was good. The second season was rough. But the third season has Mahershala, so it's going to be all right. Mahershala, I'm pretty sure it's Mahershala Ali. He was in Moonlight. Did you see Moonlight? No. He's freaking great, man.
Awesome.
Oh, he's so good. Sweet. I'm so excited. Anyway... So that's the newest episode of the Conspirators podcast. Go listen to that. And then, because that's pretty dope. So, yeah, I like witchcraft. Like I said, I like learning about witchcraft.
Yeah, there you go.
Like I said at the beginning of last week, I've just been wanting to do a witchcraft story. And so I'm glad this one fell into our laps. Even with everything we've said and done, like, yes, Potter probably killed him. That's fine.
Could be someone else.
It could be someone else. It could be that escaped Italian that no one really had anything to say about.
I really don't think it was probably them.
I feel, well, again, the vast majority of them were fine. There was one specific individual who was witnessed by a multitude of people. But even then, who's to say that's not just racism at the end of the day?
That's totally fair. I mean, we're talking right after wartime.
Yeah.
45. Yeah. The end 45. Of the war.
Yeah. So. But at the end of the day, between the weird stuff around town, especially for me, it's the watch reappearing with the witch glass.
That's just, it's so...
I know.
Okay. Okay.
I know. Right. Anyway, I think that there might be something going on. Even if it wasn't an actual witch or something like that, that he may have been murdered because... people were saying the wrong things or thinking the wrong things, which just goes to show as well, don't turn your world into the Salem witchcraft trials. Don't be saying, I saw Goody Proctor with the devil, if you didn't see Goody Proctor with the devil, okay? People's lives are at stake.
That's fair.
So, I saw Goody Proctor with the devil.
Gosh darn it, Sam.
Also, another shout out. Dude, it's like witch season. Ono Lit Class, which is one of my favorite podcasts. They talk about classic literature, like the stuff you had to read in school.
Oh, yeah.
They just did an episode on The Crucible last week.
Sweet.
So go listen to Ono Lit Class. I'm going to put that in as well in the show notes. So they're so funny. I love those people. Okay. Cool.
Witchcraft, baby.
That's what I got.
Ain't no hocus pocus here.
Ain't no hocus pocus here. All right. Well... that's Charles Walton, probably killed by Potter. That's what I would say. End of the day.
I think that's a fairly decent conclusion.
If you never want us to do a true crime episode again, let me know. I'm down with it, and we'll make that happen. If you want us to do a little bit more, let us know. We're never going to do like a whole lot more. It's not our genre, but it was kind of fun. I'm terrible at like...
yeah, it's like it's a dash. We're doing a crude crime.
I am just terrible with like dates, and I'm terrible with like lists.
Oh, dude,
and
me too.
I could not be a true crime podcaster. Shout out all you true crime podcasters out there. You're great.
Anything else we need to cover tonight?
Yeah,
Sam?
Well, we got one or two things. So we want to thank. We got one. Well, we got a few different iTunes review this week. Or iTunes ratings this week, but we only got one review. So when you just rate us 5 stars, if that's what you were going to do, when that's all you do, we appreciate it. But if you don't write a review, we can't actually see who you are or anything like that. Maybe that's how you want it, and that's fine. But we did get one person who rated us 5 stars and left a review this week.
Sweet.
And that is Jonesy8888.
Jonesy.
Dope. Now, Jonesy says, this podcast is one of the best on its subject, which is so nice. The tone is light. There is some, not a lot, of banter. I disagree. I think there's too much banter. And each episode comes across as an informative conversation. The two hosts pay attention to facts. A healthy skepticism is there, together with the love of the mysterious. Very pleasant all around. Thank you. We like to think we're pleasant. We may not be. So that's fun. That's nice. And then we got 2 new patrons this week.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So we want to thank Carl Cross.
Yeah, Carl.
And we want to thank Camille G.
Woo, Camille.
Thank you guys for becoming patrons. If you're interested in becoming a patron, go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. From there, you can learn how to support your favorite shows, get access to the episodes usually a few days earlier in their uncut edition, as well as some bonus content, which we are coming out with and going to make happen. And in fact, if I don't shut this microphone off and cry for an hour, there will be a bonus episode out by the time this episode comes out. And we're going to be this month. It's going to be, I kind of want to do a few different ones on like archaic UFO sightings.
Mm.
And so this month we're starting with something not necessarily too crazy, but essentially a rash or a flap, as John Keel would call it, of sightings in 1896 to 97. We're actually recording that right after this. So, if you want to get, yep, I know.
Excited.
If you want to get some more content, if you want to get the episodes a little earlier, and if you just want to support your favorite show, go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. Also, make sure to check out our sponsor, videoblocks.com. Go to videoblocks.com/notalone to get advantages of all of those, or take advantage of those great deals. And then there is, we've already impromptu shouted out 2 other podcasts today, but there's another podcast that I really wanted to like actually talk about and actually bring up, and it's another member of the Dark Myths. It's called The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos.
Oh, perfect.
Right?
I could use one of those.
I love Cthulhu. I know hardly anything about Cthulhu. I will just say it. I have read The Call of Cthulhu. Have you read The Call of Cthulhu?
No.
Great, great short story by H.P. Lovecraft.
I'm good.
H.P. Lovecraft is a strange man who we may talk about one day on this show, but the whole idea to the people's guide of the, or the whole idea behind the people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos is exactly that. It's essentially a podcast that dives deep into the literary world created by H.P. Lovecraft, Clark Ashton, Robert E. Howard, and many more. They talk about cult films, classics, Cthulhu, and similarly based comic books, novels, all of that. They do book reviews. They, for some of them, they just sit and they read certain sections of it. It's pretty neat stuff. So go over, again, that's The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. I will post a link to that in the show notes as well. And also go to darkmyths.org. We're a proud member of the Dark Myths Collective. It was actually my entire goal starting this podcast was to become a member of the Dark Myths, and we did it. So it's all downhill from here. Go to darkmyths.org. They, if you like our show, you're going to find dozens of new shows to like there. So that's what I've got.
Awesome, Sam.
Who did it last week?
I did.
Okay. Remember, whether you're sacrificing an old man or alone in your room, chanting over and over again, you are not alone.